Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. This is Harvey Wasserman at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're going to be joined by the great, wonderful Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president in the last election, and we hope she's going to be running again, at least I do. And we are recovering, recuperating, and calming down from the fantastic march in New York City over the weekend for the climate change. I made a last-minute decision to go out to the march. I was speaking to a group of about 100 people in central Ohio who were about to get on the bus at 11 p.m. to go to New York, and they said there was an extra seat on the bus. So I found a parking space and parked my car, jumped on the bus. We left at 1:30 in Columbus, and we arrived in New York City the following day at 1 p.m., well, actually, it was the same day, at 86 in Central Park West, and it was the very, very end of the march. It was 2 hours late in starting. We were 4 hours late getting to New York, but we made it, and what an incredible march it was. Jill Stein, you are on the phone, our own Green Party candidate for president and the president of the Green Shadow Cabinet. You were at the march. Where were you in this fantastic event?
I started out on 79th, so I don't know. I think that was about midway. But I was with a bunch of people, actually people from poor communities, low-income communities of color, and indigenous people who were part of our convergence, that is, the bringing together, getting outside of our boxes and saying, you know, we are one people, one planet. And they wanted to march through the march. So we actually started at 79th, but before the march actually took off, this group, and I was carrying one of the banners on a long line with them, they sort of marched towards the front, chanting as they went, people, planet, and peace over profit. Over and over, and it was the most glorious experience. I have to say it was the most inspired, energizing demonstration I've ever participated in. And we had the honor of being able to traverse much of the march in moving from about the midway point to somewhere up, I don't know, the halfway between there and the front. So we got to see a lot of the incredible magnificence of the march and witness it from fairly far up front. It was wonderful.
Well, it's good. I'm kind of relieved to hear you're saying that it was that great a march in your panoply of experience. You, of course, are much, much younger than I am, but I have been going to marches for 50 years. And I wrote a piece, which is posted at PRN, saying that it was the most exhilarating, beautiful, benign, really. It was just a totally benign march. And then I said, God, did I really want to say it was the greatest of all of them? And I'm happy to hear you say that, as well. It was, I guess the original official figure was 310,000 people, but it was upped by Huffington Post and some other places to 400, and it sure felt like that. I mean, when we arrived at 1 o'clock in the afternoon at 86th Street, that was kind of the end of the march. There was a vehicle behind us, but we came from Central Ohio, and we were kind of at the end. And I guess the march began at 59th Street and was beginning as we arrived. So that's 40 blocks, basically, of a four-lane street completely packed with people.
Yes. Yeah, and, it's staggering.
And I have to say that the atmosphere was almost completely without conflict. I mean, you know, I went to the march on the Pentagon in 1967, and, you know, it was mostly young people. We were angry. We were a marginal. There weren't any floats. There weren't any marching bands. You know, there were a couple of banners, but basically everybody in that march was pissed off and angry. And, you know, on the brink of violence, and we were about to, and we did actually occupy the front yard of the Pentagon, which was quite an undertaking in itself. And, of course, I was in my 20s at the time, so it was all very, very edgy. And then I've been to God knows how many demonstrations in between. But this one was just so diverse and so full of music and outrageous costumes and just humorous events and wonderfully imaginative banners. It was completely colorful. It was, you know, multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-class, multi-age. I mean, there were really, really people actually older than me there, and then lots of young people. It just seemed to have such a benevolent spirit to it, don't you think?
Yes. I mean, I think it had an incredible spirit of celebration, but it also had an incredible sense of, you know, solemnity and responsibility and, you know, sort of deep commitment to very deep change. And, you know, it seemed like people wanted to do far more than march. And in fact, the, you know, the cancellation of the gathering at the, you know, what was supposed to have been the end point of the march seemed, you know, it sort of seemed to foreclose any possibility of collective action at the end. And I think, you know, a lot of people were grateful to be able to go to flood Wall Street the next day, and there were many thousands that showed up for that. You know, it just felt like the march was shocking to everyone. You know, the most recent predictions had been more like it had started off at 500,000, then it was down to 100,000, and then it was down to 60,000, and people weren't sure what to expect. And then it turned out, you know, it was practically 500,000 people who came out. And, you know, it just felt like people were deeply primed for deep action and kind of came to the march wondering what would happen in a spirit of, you know, I think celebration and agitation, you know, it was all there, and education, you know, and all those things, I think, live on, and we've shocked ourselves. We had a look in the mirror, and we discovered that we are far bigger and deeper and more diverse and more powerful than anything we would have expected. And I think we're in the process right now of just asking ourselves, what do we do? This march really marked the end of an era. It's about the meeting of the United Nations, but no one really expects the United Nations, having done nothing for 20 years, to suddenly, you know, free itself from its corporate masters right now. You know, our governments have sold us down the creek, and the UN is really a representative of governments and not of people. So I think we're asking ourselves, what is next? We're closing out the old climate movement, you know, the movement that was strictly about, you know, parts per million of CO2, and we've broadened it to a movement which is about justice, you know, and it's about, you know, ending nuclear power and ending nuclear weapons and ending the wars and ending the fossil fuel economy and creating, you know, jobs in our communities that transition us on an emergency basis to clean renewable energy, to public transportation, to a sustainable, organic, locally based food system, you know, to ecological restoration. You know, I think people have a sense of what we must do, and it's bigger than, you know, kind of simply reducing our carbon emissions. It's also about changing this predatory corporate capitalist system that is exploiting resources, exploiting the planet, and exploiting people. And I think we're all sort of looking around right now and taking stock of who we are, how big, deep, and powerful this movement is, and asking ourselves, you know, what is our next move? It's clearly, you know, not going to be handed to us on a platter. And this is a wonderful time, I think, coming out of this very exhilarated event for us to, you know, start thinking and talking about what is our next move, what's our next goal, what's our next structure.
Well said, Jill Stein. We're talking with Jill Stein, a Green Party candidate for president in what year was that? 2012. And hopefully I'm supporting you to be the candidate again, 2016. I think you're a great candidate. We need a woman in the White House, and it ain't Hillary in my book.
I'm kidding.
So at any rate, and it is true what comes next. But let's talk first about the depth of this. I did not plan to go. My daughter is in the midst of having my ninth grandchild, and so I was that, and she's in L.A., and that was part of the travel planning. And trying to figure it out, and we are hoping everything goes well, and I will report back on the show next week or week after, whenever the baby is born, and we'll figure all that out. And so what happened,
are you still there, Harvey? I'm not hearing you.
Oh God. We are, you know, this show, we always have gremlins here, and this is another gremlin. Can you hear me now?
Now I hear you. Okay, great.
Okay, great. So, and no fault of the people in New York, by the way. I believe that the CIA and the FBI are just really terrified of Solartopia. And so we always are visited by little technical gremlins, but we get through it and we always have a great show. And you've been on before and you're wonderful, Joe. So we'll stick through it. So at any rate, I did not plan to go, but I saw the buzz that was really starting to happen on the internet. And, you know, if you live on the internet, like so many of us do, you start to get a feel for these things. And I could start to see that this was going to be one hell of a great march. And on Saturday morning, they asked me to come speak. The Sierra Club asked me to come speak downtown Columbus because a busload of people, along with two vans, was heading from Kansas, for God's sakes, to the march in New York. Now, I hate riding the bus. It is sheer torture to me. And the idea that people would come all the way from Kansas and ride 24 hours or more to New York City for a five-hour march completely blew my mind. And so I went down to speak to these folks, and I was expecting a whole bunch of young people who wouldn't really care about riding a bus. And it turns out these people were in there. There were some young people on there, but there were people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, for God's sakes, who were riding the bus, who had gotten on the bus Friday morning. They arrived in Columbus, you know, God knows when, 8 in the morning, and then they were going to ride another 12 hours and camp outside of New York City in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and then go in Sunday morning, and then leave Sunday night, get back on the bus Sunday night, and ride 24 hours back to Kansas. I mean, you know, and I was told by my friend Larry Bensky in San Francisco that he teaches a class there. He said between 100 and 150 students were getting on the train in San Francisco to go to New York for 3-4 days on the train to be in New York for this march. And it was staggering to me. And so I talked to I interviewed all the people I could who were on the bus going from Kansas to New York. And these are working people. These are plain, ordinary, middle Americans, terrified of what's happening to the climate. Republicans and Democrats and independents, you know, former hippies, former military people, are just a total cross-section. And they were just totally focused, had no questions at all about riding on these terribly uncomfortable buses all the way across the country for a 5-6 hour experience and then riding all the way back. It just completely blew my mind. And, you know, and so at that point on Saturday morning, I knew this was really powerful. And I was offered the last seat on that night's bus to go from Columbus to New York. And I did not make up my mind until I spoke. They asked me to speak to, there were about 125 or so people at a union parking lot in Columbus about to get on the bus. And wow. I just got on the bus. And we left at 1:30. We got to New York, 11 and a half hours later.
Oh my God.
And it was staggering to me. Absolutely fantastic.
Wow. More power to you, Harvey. I want to tell you about what happened before the march. Many of us felt like bringing tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people together was too good an opportunity to pass up for doing movement building. Because as you know, you can do the most amazing march in the world and the media can choose to ignore it. Or even if they report it, you know, power holders can choose to ignore it. And we've done magnificent and enormous 500,000 demonstrations in the past, you know, and many millions of people around the world. And sometimes they're completely ignored. So we wanted to be sure that this gathering, all this expenditure of fossil fuel energy to get there, you know, was going to result in something lasting that wouldn't depend on the good graces of corporate media or our sold-out Wall Street politicians. So we arranged to have a conference and a Skillshare, a series of workshops, which we called a convergence. And we called it, in fact, a climate convergence, for people, planet, and peace over profit. So the idea was to bring together the different streams which are impacted by climate and to build a bigger movement, which is not only a climate justice movement, but also a movement for economic justice and racial justice and health justice and education justice and for peace and to bring us together. And we had about 2 months, really. We got some funding from a progressive organization to do this. And we had really, it was more like 6 weeks to get the word out and let people know about it. And it was so exciting to see how many of us there are who really understand that the climate is really the emergency that brings us together. And that, in fact, we cannot solve the climate movement while the neoliberal agenda rages on in the economy, in the ecology beyond climate, in peace and democracy, that all of those sectors of society, you know, really need to be transformed. And there's no way we're going to fix the climate, you know, unless we also have a democracy, unless we can also address the biggest purveyor of fossil fuels and violence, for that matter, in the world, which is the U.S. military, that all of these issues have to be solved together. And, you know, and in fact, fortunately, there are transformative solutions that actually address all of them. It's not only impossible to address them piecemeal, but it is actually, it's a no-brainer. It's a win-win, and it's affordable. And it's immediately accessible to do all of those things in one fell swoop, to create the tens of millions of jobs in the U.S. alone and even more around the world, to transform our economy to a green, clean energy economy overnight. You know, we know we can do it here by 2030. The studies have been done. We can have a renewable energy economy by 2030, 100% wind, water, and sun, zero nuclear, zero fossil fuel. We can do that at the same time that we demilitarize and at the same time that we basically, you know, end the climate crisis. And it takes emergency action in order for us to truly end the climate crisis. So at any rate, we held this conference, and we had indigenous you know, tribes represented from all over the U.S. and beyond the U.S. We had participation from climate justice struggles in South Africa, where they're trying to, you know, fight the expansion of fossil fuel ports. We had indigenous leaders from Oregon who came in, who have just won, in fact, their first battles to stop the new coal ports that are that there's a big push to build on the West Coast. We had an enormous gathering of the peace movement. Over 20 national groups created what was called the Peace Table and brought the Peace Table under the umbrella of the convergence, the climate convergence for people, planet, and peace over profit. You know, we had climate justice communities from the Gulf Coast, you know, to Hurricane Sandy and beyond, and we had, you know, all sorts of people who've, you know, been studying the system dimension of the issue and the role of finance and banking and why we need, you know, why we need capital and resources that are accessible to everybody, why we need state-owned and municipal-owned banks and municipal utilities that allow people to choose energy that's healthy for people and for the planet, as well as, you know, to take the profiteering out of the cost of energy and so on. So, and it was just, we held two major plenary sessions. Naomi Klein was at one of them, and a variety of other speakers from all around the planet, really. And it was absolutely incredible. It's actually, it's recorded, it's on video. If you go to globalclimateconvergence.org, the videos will soon be posted there. They're also available on the Green Party's video stream, whose URL I don't have at the moment, but I will try to find that and report back to you. At any rate, it was just such a wonderful, inspired conference, which was absolutely sold out and which wound up firmly, you know, in the black. We weren't sure we were going to have the money to cover it, but a lot of resources came in from people who really wanted to support the effort. And there will be follow-ons to it from people who really wanted to use this moment of the march and this moment of the climate summit as the UN process is grinding to a halt. People wanted to use that time to actually come together and to sit down and to strategize and bring our movements together, because the minute we cross-link them, the minute we get out of our silos that leave us divided and conquered, and operating on independent schedules with independent strategies and visions, you know, the minute we sync them, the minute we synchronize, the minute we coordinate our strategies, we become an overwhelming and unstoppable force. And that's really where we need to be, you know, coming out of this transformative moment that we're in.
And I that's beautifully spoken, Jill. And I think we're talking with Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate in 2012 and the next president of the United States, as far as I'm concerned. And you were a major organizer in these events. And I kind of watched them come together from afar. And it was really great. And I have to comment that the coming together of this event was so relative. Of course, you were on an inside, and I was not, but I did not, and correct me if I'm wrong, I did not see virtually any sectarianism or factionalism or all the ideological nonsense that we suffered through with the war, with the movement against the war in Vietnam and with the civil rights movement and much of the labor movement. This seemed to be a movement that had a preformed consensus that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that seemed to be assume the need and the power of diversity, and to be willing to accommodate many, many different points of view. And I want to point to one in specific. Of course, there's been an argument about climate and nuclear power. Some people who have been working against climate change, you know, to solve climate change, have advocated nuclear as a solution, which of course doesn't fly in any stretch of the imagination in my world. And yet, you know, it didn't seem to arise as much of a conflict at all in this, and or much of anywhere else. I didn't see any major sectarian divisions leading up to this march. And can you tell us, were there any, or was it really as consensual as it seemed?
It was totally. We were very clear at the outset that our position was that we need to survive, and that we needed to be very clear in our ask, in our demands, in our vision of where we were going. We were not going to accept half a loaf. Half of survival is not okay. You cannot trade, you know, toxic fossil fuels for toxic and deadly nuclear power. And we were the same way on war. You know, it's not okay to simply focus on the climate and not address, you know, and not address the catastrophe of the expanding war on terror, which is fundamentally a war for, you know, for fossil fuels and expanding markets. That we needed to be very clear that we needed a deep, systemic, and comprehensive solution. And we were going to be, you know, kind of a coalition of, shall we say, not the willing, but the, you know, the of integrity. We weren't here to cut deals with power holders, and nor were we corporate sponsored. We were completely independent of money that came with strings. So we were a coalition of grassroots groups, and we reflected the consensus that actually already exists among grassroots groups. You know, one of the big problems is that many of the big, you know, the big inside the beltway nonprofits are getting corporate money, and so their agendas have been, you know, compromised in a lethal way. And they've accepted nuclear power. Many have accepted, you know, the so-called RED, the reducing emissions for to reduce through deforestation and forest degradation. You know, which is it's sort of a Wall Street solution. We are not about market solutions. We are not about, you know, looking to those who've caused this problem among financiers, among Wall Street. We're not looking to the deep pockets to solve this problem. There are grassroots solutions right now that can solve this overnight. And we need public investment. You know, we need dollars. But we don't need to sell our souls to, you know, to the banksters in order to make this happen. So we really had an agenda of integrity that said no sellout. We're not doing that. This is all about solutions that are people-powered and that have passed that vetting. And so everyone who came to the table, you know, we didn't have people coming who were on corporate budgets or who were, well, actually, many of the big nonprofits actually did participate, though it tended more to be their local chapters rather than the big national groups. So, you know, we had very broad participation from across all sectors, and there was agreement from the get-go. This is about people, planet, and peace over profit, and acknowledging that this profiteering corporate capitalist system is at the core of the problem here, sort of stop those at the gate, you know, who were going to come promoting nuclear power or promoting, you know, buying up forests that belong to indigenous people and kicking them out, you know, in order for, you know, the Rockefeller brothers to own, you know, the forest or whoever, you know, big investors to own the forest. That's not a solution, you know. So we had, you know, I think when you put those kinds of filters into your organizing, you may eliminate 1%, you know, and that's the top 1%. And that's okay. Thank you very much. We'll do just fine without the top 1% messing up the agenda and sort of sabotaging the power that you get when you actually stand up for the solutions that will move us forward to a peaceful, just, green future that we deserve.
Yeah, and you know, this was a march that really spoke for itself. You know, it was by far the most diverse gathering of human beings that I have ever seen in terms of race, gender, class, sexual preference, political points of view, at least, you know, on the left. And I mean, we did not see any pro-nuclear floats. That's for sure. We didn't see any corporate guys. And it was absolutely without any trace of rancor The other thing was, of course, Jill Stein of the Green Party, the commitment to nonviolence. It was a debatable issue through much of the anti-war and civil rights movement. But this this march, the underpinning, the floor, the foundation, was a universal commitment to nonviolence. And I think that really helped set the tone. We're going to take a short break with Jill Stein here. Fabulous discussion, Jill. I'm so honored to have you on. We're going to come back in 3 minutes and continue. And I want to talk about solutions now as we move ahead.
Wonderful. Honor is mine, Harvey. Thank you.
Okay. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
New plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam, road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Home sweet home to me, Solartopia, that's the future for me, green powered energy, windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaic cells with solar panels everywhere, solar cars, fast trains, bicycles, hydroplanes, get you home in under an hour.
For the Bears. That's my good buddy Dana Lyon singing the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song. Dana, of course, the man of Cows with Guns fame. 2 million, 2 million views of that wonderful Cows with Guns video on YouTube. Dana, of course, is the inspiration for many people in the vegan movement, and there were lots of vegans. There was a giant cow, actually, at this march in New York City. It was said, we all have a stake in global warming, STEAK, advocating an end to the eating of meat, which is certainly an industrial meat, industrial produced meat, I heartily endorse. We're with Jill Stein, the 2012 candidate from the Green Party for president. Hopefully our next president of the United States, if she can be persuaded to run again. And we are talking about this fabulous march in New York City. And we're gonna segue in now, Jill, if it's okay, to talk about specifics of what people do. People ask me all the time what they can do, and I say, without exception, find your worst local polluter and shut them down. Act locally. And I have to say that the people that I met on this march were very, very in tune with that. You know, I think not that many people on the march either knew or cared one bit about the United Nations and the fact that there was a conference coming up there and then Obama would speak. This was not about asking our politicians to change policy. This was about taking hold of power at the grassroots and really making it happen and forcing the politicians to follow us. Is that an overstatement, Jill Stein?
No, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, the march was called at this time because of the UN process. And, you know, I think on the part of the organizers, there was at least in part the intention to say, look how powerful, you know, the climate movement is. Look how intense and deep and broad the support is for, transformative climate action and solutions. So I think the intent was there, but you're absolutely right. Out on the street, I think people have long since lost confidence in, you know, not only the UN process here, but our own governments as well. And, it is increasingly, it's up to us. And at this point, it's up to us and nobody else, to stop the current pollution and the growth of pollution exploitation, the extractive economy, in all of its forms. And I think what's really wonderful is that people recognize there are many dimensions to this. So this is about shutting down our nuclear power plants as much as our coal plants, and, you know, stopping fracking in its tracks. And it's also about the expansion. It's about the new facilities that are being laid down. It's about the pipelines that are crisscrossing the nation, not only the pipelines for, you know, Alberta tar sands or tar sands from, you know, the Bakken tar sands in North Dakota. It's also about, you know, the pipelines for fracked natural gas, and it's about the coal trains. You know, there are just so many points of expansion now under our dear, you know, climate-conscious president, and I say that, you know, facetiously, Barack Obama. We've seen this absolute massive expansion. Some of it doesn't get consumed in the U.S., so he can say that, you know, we've reduced our emissions. That, of course, doesn't account for the methane, which is coming out of the fracking, you know, the, just the incredible proliferation of fracking mechanics all over the country. But, you know, even despite that claim that our emissions have been reduced, if you were to ignore methane coming out of the fracking wells, you know, the only reasons our numbers are down is because we're selling it all over the planet, you know. So the atmosphere doesn't separate out emissions or separate out impacts, you know. We're one nation as far as the planet is concerned, and we need to stop all those emissions everywhere. And this is the growing power, I think, that we're realizing, that we can stop this, and we are stopping this. You know, over 300 communities around the country have banned fracking. They've just said no, and actually it was upheld in a recent Supreme Court decision that that this is, you know, this is actually constitutional. We can do it, and of course we should. Property right. should not, people and human health, and it's an outrage that, you know, that's done. But, you know, there's so much that we can do, not only to stop the poison, you know, and the degradation, and that includes the mowing down of our forests for biofuels as well. You know, it also includes what we're doing on the opposite side that you've been so very involved with, Harvey. It's about the solartopia. It's about starting the solar farm, or, you know, the community gardens, or, you know, or supporting, you know, your local worker co-ops and creating a new economy, and supporting credit unions and banks. You know, all this stuff goes together. And it's not only what we have to stop, it's also what we have to start. And we saw all of that, you know, on beautiful display in the march.
Well, I agree with you 100%. I actually think that this march had a lot to do with when it was called, which is the fall equinox. I mean, it's a very auspicious date. And I would advocate at this point in time, having seen this march, that we actually, at least for a while, make it an annual event. And to have people back again. The march to me had virtually no connection to the United Nations. It was a march. No one I met on the march said, well, we're marching to persuade the United Nations to do something about global warming. No, people were marching because the climate is a problem, and all these other problems that you mentioned, all these other issues, and we were able to come together in a totally unique way, incredibly diverse, both in terms of issue, as we said, in class, race, age, gender, sexual preference. I mean, everybody was there and felt very secure. There was a tremendous feeling of peace in this march, which you don't always get in political marches. Everybody felt very, that I could tell, felt very, very comfortable on this march. And so I think we ought to start to think about doing it next year in Chicago and the year after that in Boston or in San Francisco. I mean, make it a global event, but just build our numbers and our sense of unity in that respect. It's just a suggestion to throw out there. I'm sure other people have talked about it, but, you know, there is something very special about an equinox. And, you know, being at least part pagan myself, I think that had a bit to do with it. So, but let's talk now, Jill Stein, about issues and things we need to do. I have read a piece recently that says that civil disobedience, massive civil disobedience, is the key. And I tend to disagree. I think that what we need to do is to tackle, first of all, people have to choose the issue that moves them. And, you know, everybody says, what can I do? And my response is always, do what you're most comfortable doing. If the climate issue moves you, do that. If it's social justice, move that. If it's nuclear power, if it's you know, gender-based issues, they all are part of the whole. And everybody is going to be good and best suited and most comfortable and most inspired with whatever piece of the pie that comes before them. And the people I talked to on this march and on the buses were incredibly savvy, all of them, about what they're working on. And I think that the key in the long run is an ecological, a movement that itself is ecological. There's a human ecology to activism that I think that people do what they are best suited to do. And sometimes you get blank stares on that, but then it sinks in. You know, none of these issues takes precedence over any of the others. You know, global climate, it's a big deal. But I think all of them are such a big piece of the pie, as we saw in this march, that if people will just do what moves them most to do, then in the long run, that's the best way to move forward. What do you think?
Well, absolutely. And I think what is really empowering to people is to see our numbers, you know. People were feeling so good because we were just an ocean of humanity. And I think what we need right now is to know our power and to use our power. And there's nothing like standing up, you know, synchronizing our watches and all standing up on the same day that gives us a sense of power. But this is the power that we actually have, that we're denied, you know, by the media that ignores us and misreports us and also frames us as a divided and conquered movement. And as long as we allow that to happen, we will continue to be divided and conquered. And as much as I love a march, we need to do more than that. We actually need results, and we need them soon. And, you know, I think it's really important for us to move quickly towards the next step that allows us to continue to exert this power and to get real consequences from it, which includes closing down, you know, polluters, closing down the war machine, opening up and transforming our economy. This is not rocket science. This is not some high and lofty ideal. This is what must be done if we're going to survive, and it must be done quickly if we're going to survive. And I think it's not too much to ask that we do this. And I think in a way it's not that we have to ask people, it's that we give ourselves permission to actually do what we need to do. And we make it powerful by synchronizing our watches and doing it together. So, you know, what's on my mind and the minds of many people I've talked to is actually of having a global day of action, or maybe it's a week of action, in which we both, we take civil disobedience actions in our communities to shut down polluters, and we all do it on the same day. And in some cases, that may be, you know, progressive unions who are closing down transportation, or the seaport workers, you know, who are closing down the ports, you know, that we have a day of massive civil disobedience in all sectors of society and in all walks of life. So it may take the form of lockdown to your pipeline, or it may take the form of simply not participating in the fossil fuel economy. But that everybody, you know, has a synchronized date, and we're all doing it at once. At the same time, we're showcasing our solutions, and we're building our community gardens, and we're building our solar farms, and we're establishing our, you know, our worker cooperatives, and, you know, or we're striking for wages, decent wages, and the right to a union, even at our fast food joints, you know, that we have some massive participatory day of celebration and agitation, you know, on behalf of the climate, defined broadly. It's not only the climate of our atmosphere, it's the climate of our economy, the climate of our democracy, the climate of our politics. So that we have a day of massive disengagement from the engines of destruction in our economy and of our Mother Earth. And we do it all in sync to show, in fact, not only that we're numerous and we're glorious, but that we also can stop the machine at the same time that we transform the machine. And we start at our community level, we start the solutions on the ground that are within our reach right now. And we target some date that might be 6 months off or 9 months off. You know, Earth Day to May Day might be the time to do it. Earth Day to May Day, 10 days apart, the day of celebrating the planet and the day of celebrating the people and immigrants and workers. And to have a, you know, a day or perhaps a week in there in which we have a massive strike, climate strike, a new kind of strike, a strike to withdraw from the lethal old predatory machine and create right now on the ground the world that we need right now. Let's get to work. And if we're doing it in sync, we can demonstrate our power at the same time we demonstrate the solutions that we already have at hand. And
well, I think that's a great idea. I really like that. It needs to be local as well as global. In other words,
exactly.
You know, I remember in 1967, it made sense for us to all go march on the Pentagon. And the Pentagon is still a problem after all these years, but it's not the problem. It's not the only problem. And I think that we need to do this, you know, that wonderful phrase, think globally, act locally, to empower people in a global solidarity sense to act on their local pipelines, their local polluters, their local nuclear plants. And I would suggest, Jill Stein, that we do this in sync with our Mother Earth and that we look at the solstices and the equinoxes. You know, I am convinced in my own little pagan way that one of the reasons this march was so powerful is because it did come on the equinox. And I like to think in those terms. Rather than picking dates arbitrarily, we think about stuff that has power of its own in the patterns of our Mother Earth. We're talking with Jill Stein, a presidential candidate for the Green Party in 2012 and president of the Green Shadow Cabinet at the moment. And by way of disclosure, I am the Secretary of Energy of the Green Shadow Cabinet. I did send you a piece. I hope you'll post it, Jill. It's about the march. It's at PRN FM, our website here.
It's a wonderful piece. Yes.
Thank you.
Terrific.
And I'm going to write again. I do want to suggest, and we only have you. You are so good. I mean, time is just flying by. I'm going to have you back in a very short period of time.
That's a catch. Coach Bill, you coach that, right?
To talk right, about exactly it some more. But I think that the number one issue facing us at the moment, and I actually didn't see any floats about it, but it is net neutrality. And because, you know, we are so dependent on the Internet, this global a method of communication, that I would like to see, you know, a part of the momentum of this global movement on climate to comprehend how absolutely important protecting the Internet is right now. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, this is about whether we will have any shred of, you know, democratic communications left at all, because the others have been, you know, corporate media, television, you know, printed media has been pretty well locked down by, you know, the forces of darkness. And the Internet is what allows us, you know, it's why a free press is critical to democracy. It's why we have a First Amendment, you know, to ensure our right to communicate and to educate each other. And the Internet is it right now. It is our communication space for democracy. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And in fact, Arvie, I just want to mention that as part of this convergence for people, planet, and peace over profit, you know, we have a 10-point, you know, agenda, which includes, you know, Internet freedom and includes freeing up our airwaves as well and ensuring that we have you know, free and open communications in every form possible. So I agree with you. It's one of those pieces which is not separable. You know, in my prior life, I was a healthcare provider. I was a medical doctor, and no one ever, came into the medical clinic and said, "Hey, doc, would you please just take care of my kidney? Forget my heart, forget my lungs,
right.
You know, forget my digestive system. You know, everybody knows that we are whole people. And same is true, you know, with regard to these needs. I don't get siloing at all. Siloing, you know, putting our needs and our issues into silos has been our tradition for organizing in this country for quite some time. We need to leave it behind. We need to keep doing that work. You know, the motto from 17th century sailors, you know, was one hand for the ship and one hand for yourself. We got to keep doing what we're doing, but we've got to link together. And I really want to encourage people, go to the greenshadowcabinet.us and see how it comes together at the policy level, but also go to globalclimateconvergence.org and be part of this convergence to make climate the glue, the emergency that brings us together to create a climate of justice, not only for the atmospheric climate, but for the economic climate, for the racial climate, for the democracy climate. All of these climates need to come together in an emergency because the clock is ticking on our atmospheric climate. We don't have long to fix this. It needs to be treated as an all-out emergency. So join us now, and together we are absolutely unstoppable.
Give us those websites again, Jill, where you would recommend people go.
Great. So the first one right now coming out of this march is Global Climate Convergence. That's all one word, globalclimateconvergence.org. That was really the movement building up to the march that helped bring us together along with another partner organization, System Change, Not Climate Change. We created this convergence conference for people, planet, and peace over profit. And Harvey, I have to tell you, when we marched through the march, and even when we marched with the march, we did a march internal to the march before it began moving, and we sort of got to show our banner to everybody. And people began chanting with us and applauding and taking photos of this march. It was like the lights went on in everybody's head when they saw people, planet, peace over profit. It's like everybody was like, suddenly it was, aha, that's what this is about. It's not only, you know, our atmosphere, is everything that we're doing on the planet, and we need peace if we're going to achieve this. And it was just so wonderful to see that, you know, this is what brings us together. In Alice Walker's words, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with. So
that's fantastic.
That
and Joe, unfortunately, we're down to the last 2 minutes here. I want to have you back either next week or the week after. Let's discuss that. Look at
that
your calendar, because we need to, and I love what you've said about climate, because, you know, the climate on this march was absolutely magical. And the climate really doesn't refer just to the temperature of the planet. It does refer to our social, our economic, our cultural climate. And we have seen spectacular victories in this country that people have to understand when it comes to sexual preference, when it comes to gender relations, to race. I mean, we have tremendous problems still, but we have come a long way. And now we do have a solution at hand, and the climate that we need to create is one of peace, love, and rock and roll. and we've got all those things, right?
Exactly. And the biggest, you know, the biggest hurdle there is believing in ourselves. As Alice Walker said, it's all about recognizing the power that we already have. And once we link arms, once we've crossed these walls that divide us into our different silos of activism, the minute we do that, you know, we have not just a plurality, we have an outright majority of people who want peace, justice, and a sustainable green future, and democracy. We've got the numbers. It's all about linking up, getting organized, and making it happen.
Well, you got that, Jill. Jill Stein, you are just a total treasure. And if you'll come back in 2 weeks, I think I can, if you can look at your schedule, we'll schedule you back. We need to continue this conversation. It's just been an hour of pure joy, like that march and like our future ahead of us if we can come together. Thank you so much, Jill Stein, for being with us. Green Party candidate for president in 2012, the next president of the United States. And we will be back next week to talk about nuclear power, and hopefully the week after. Jill, you can come back and join us again. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Harvey Wasserman with Jill Stein from the Green Shadow Cabinet. We will see you next week.
Adam, Was there an Eve, or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.